abandon us. This is episode 22, Sleepless in Seattle from 1993. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and Mike, here to talk about this movie in which Tom Hanks was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy, which, weirdly enough, so that same year at the Golden Globes, he gets nominated for Best Actor in a Drama for Philadelphia and wins that. I've still never seen Philadelphia. We'll get to that in 2 weeks. That's the next movie that we're doing.
It's heavy, man. It's heavy.
Oh, boy. But you can't compare, I don't think, this to a movie in which he gets AIDS and dies, question mark?
I'll tell you this much. I cried in both movies, watching both films, and this is the first time I saw this. One of my favorite lines from the movie Scrooged, anytime this happens, it was like Niagara Falls in my living room when I watched this movie.
Oh, man.
It was unexpected, I'll just say that.
Well, with us tonight, we have a professional crier. You heard her last episode talking about the waterworks of Niagara Falls in her living room while watching A League of Their Own. We have welcome back from Wistful Thinking, Miss Kara Gale-O'Regan. Hello, Kara.
Hello. I think I only cried 4 times during this.
Okay, so I need to say up front, I did not cry. I did get chills at the end when they see each other on the rooftop. I think, and Mike, I want you to do your plot summary, and I want to actually explain what the movie's actually about, but I feel like in this movie, you could see this movie that Tom Hanks thinks Meg Ryan's a ghost. Like, she just appears places, and it's just like, I'm here, get used to it. It's like, wait, where, who are you? Like, she almost gets run over. It's just like, who is this woman? Like, this ethereal being. You know, the way that he's saying nothing is perfect, no one is perfect, and he, like, stops himself when he sees her for the first time, like, this, like, beautiful woman that is everything he wants. I think there is definitely a, probably, you know, there should be if there's not, a YouTube video where someone dives down a rabbit hole about how she was dead the entire time and none of this is real and it's all like, it's a Jacob's Ladder situation in the kid's head. I feel like it's a possibility. That's all I'm saying.
You know what I think it is? It's a reverse Cities of Angels action happening.
Ooh, yes.
Where she's the angel.
Absolutely. I was trying to remember why I was getting such City of Angels vibes and I realized, oh, just now, because she's in that. But Meg Ryan, obviously back from Joe vs. the Volcano. This is the part two of our Meg Ryan triptych coming up later. Carol will be on once again to talk about You've Got Mail. So stick around for that in, I don't know, 6 or 7 episodes, whatever. But before we go further, Mike, please explain to anyone who has not seen this movie, which is not as... This feels like the kind of movie that should be available to stream for free. This just feels like the kind of comfort blanket to people that it should just be available. And it's not. Like, you have to pay for this.
Like, I don't know why I'm quoting other movies, but in Wayne's World, there's like, you know, when he's talking about like Frampton Comes Alive, they would issue you that if you lived in the suburbs, you just get like a free copy sent to you in the mail. I feel like people should just get this movie sent to them for free.
Yeah, like once, if you are a woman, once you turn 35, you just get a copy of this in the mail.
Oh, I'm pretty sure my mom got a VHS copy of it that way.
I'm sure. I mean, yeah.
I mean, look, I could also see this opening up a whole other avenue to bereaved men, you know, widowers and things like that nature.
Like you send them the Dirty Dozen.
Oh, right. That's a funny scene. That's a great moment.
All improvised, that scene. Completely improvised on the spot. Yes, yes, yes. But Mike, if people have not received their copy, their VHS copy in the mail of Sleepless in Seattle, please explain what this movie is about.
All right. This is going to be really pretty short. It's off and off the cuff. Tom Hanks, when the movie starts, his wife has just passed away and he is a single father. And he, one day, his son calls into a talk show on the radio about relationships and gets his father on the line with the therapist. And listening on the other end in her car, and it happens to be Christmas, I think. So listening in her car is Meg Ryan, who is a reporter, and she's very interested in the story. It starts popping up like throughout her life. It's part of her assignment at work. She's a reporter. She ends up pursuing Tom Hanks, who's known as Sleepless in Seattle, his call sign on the radio show. And yeah, just through Hollywood magic and rom-com romance fantasy, they end up getting together at the end, at the top of the Empire State Building. I mean, a whole lot of stuff is going on, but basically, yes, Meg Ryan hears about this on the radio, seeks him out, and they do indeed end up together in the end.
Happily ever after? Question mark, I guess, because they sort of seem meant to be together, but we don't know. We don't see. We don't know what happened.
She knows everything about him, and he knows nothing about her, but the son knows quite a bit, but like, he knows nothing except that she's beautiful.
So I had never seen this movie before. I think, Kara, you had seen this. Now, you've seen this twice now, but you watched it both times before tonight, right? Like, you had not seen, had you seen this before or no?
Yeah. I think I had maybe seen it once or twice in like the mid-90s. And then I watched it twice in 2 days.
Mike, what about you? Had you seen it before, or is this your first time too?
No, so this is my very first time. This is one of those other movies, I wouldn't say I actively avoided it, but I just never had any interest in it for whatever reason, and which is strange, because Nora Ephron wrote one of my all-time favorite movies ever, My Blue Heaven.
Huh, okay.
Her husband wrote Goodfellas, and like at the time he was interviewing Henry Hill, she was like listening in, and it's kind of a pseudo-sequel to Goodfellas, if you've ever seen it, but that's a terrific movie. But this movie totally won me over, I have to say. Like, I was never a big rom-com guy, or like back then they used to call them chick flicks. I think that's a terrible sort of misnomer, but because like I get it now, like this movie sort of opened my eyes to the whole genre, and I understand, and I liked it quite a bit.
Wait, this movie did tonight? Like this time, this you had your eyes open to rom-coms this week because of this movie?
Yeah, pretty much. Like this, for some reason with this one, it clicks. Like I understand the genre now. Like I get the whole thing, and I love it now. Like I don't know. I know I've seen a bunch, but they've always seemed so so cookie cutter. This one really feels like unique.
Wait, this doesn't?
Well, no, I mean, the way that sequences go on, and the structure of it, and how it pulls from other movies, and at times there's, like, animation and things, I think it's, like, wholly, like, its own kind of thing within the genre.
So, here's the thing about this movie that I think will kind of, like, bridge the gap between where the two of you are.
I do want to clarify, like, I do not, like, hate this movie. I'm just, like, I'm stunned, because we did, like, I fell in love with rom-coms because of Cage Club, because of Nicolas Cage and rom-coms.
Right.
And I feel like we've seen a bunch of very good ones to then just have this one be like, because I don't think this is like a transcendent experience.
Well, it's like a handbook for how to watch a rom-com. It like teaches you what a rom-com is and how to watch and enjoy it, because it's this kind of meta narrative about rom-coms. You know, it's like the ultimate rom-com kind of.
I'm down with that. Like it almost, there's something meta about it without breaking the fourth wall. Like the way that there's something about the characterization of the people and something about it.
In the movie, they're actually watching a specific, I don't know if
An Affair to Remember, right?
Yeah, I don't know if that's technically a rom-com. I don't think there's much comedy in that, but they're watching the movie, they're talking about the movie, and they're having this kind of ongoing conversation about like expectations versus reality and like what we expect of relationships and what we see in the movies versus like what they are in real life.
Yes, the quote I think is, "That's your problem. You don't want to be in love. You want to be in love in a movie."
Mm-hmm.
There's the idealized version, which this is. Like, I guess it's meta in that way, and it is. I think the problem that I kind of had with it is that it wasn't exactly the movie that I thought it was going to be. And again, not knowing anything about anything. And I feel like this also happened this summer in my Julia Roberts mini binge, which I talked about on Not Her Again with Michael Domenico. When I saw My Best Friend's Wedding, I did not realize that it was going to be Dermot Mulroney and Julia Roberts as best friends. Like, that didn't click in my brain. I was thinking, like, it was two women best friends or something. Like, I was just like, I just had this weird kind of preconceived notion of what it was going to be, and it took me time to sort of align myself within the world. And so here I just thought, I guess there's kind of two different core basic kinds of rom-coms. It's like where they either know each other and they sort of bicker and bicker, and in the end they get together. Or I guess this is the other one where like they just don't know each other at all and then they finally meet and the movie ends. But I was kind of hoping for, especially after Joe vs. the Volcano and how great they are together on screen, like the chemistry, I was hoping for more Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan, and they're on screen together for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And I just sort of wanted more of that. Like I wanted them in whatever regard, in whatever capacity, together, as opposed to trying to basically find, unknowingly trying to find one another.
Have you seen When Harry Met Sally?
Not yet, no.
Oh my goodness.
I've seen it, but I dislike it.
Interesting, interesting. Why?
But Mike, have you seen it since your brain was open?
No,
since you are now the
no.
expanding brain meme.
See, you got to go back and watch
I gotta
it now.
Rewatch it now. Yeah.
So When Harry Met Sally was also at least partially written by Nora Ephron, and it was directed by Rob Reiner. And so when they were working on the script for When Harry Met Sally, they felt like they couldn't really get an authentic female voice for the character of Sally, and that was when they brought Nora on board. And that's also Meg Ryan. I mean, Meg Ryan as Sally is like, she's perfect. It's so good. It's like all of the kind of quirkiness from this movie, but less, maybe more annoying. I don't know. I just like that one a lot more than I like this one.
I remember my problem being more of the Billy Crystal vibe. Like, I think it's just him. Because I love the other stuff with Carrie Fisher and everything. And, like, I do love Meg Ryan in that. So, yeah, I definitely have to give it a rewatch.
At one point, this movie is supposed to be directed by Gary Marshall. Please call me Gary. And there's the Penny Marshall connection there, because she directed Tom Hanks in two movies. And Penny Marshall was married at one point to Rob Reiner, who's in this movie. There is kind of that whole...
Yeah, I feel like there are more connections between the two of them also. Actually, Nora Ephron was at one point married to Carl Bernstein of, like, Woodward and Bernstein fame. Her book, which was ultimately made into a movie starring Meryl Streep called Heartburn, which is, like, fictionalized, but it's, like, based on their relationship. Nora Ephron basically, like, leaked who Deep Throat was, and nobody paid attention or cared.
Wait, what? Really?
Yeah. It's in the book.
All right.
I think one reason this movie really sort of clicked with me as far as, like, trying to, not trying to, but as far as understanding, like, this whole, like, rom-com genre thing is because I feel like this movie starts in a very realistic place, like, super heavy, very dramatic and stuff, and it gradually, like, gets to a fairy tale ending, right? But by the time we're there, it feels so gradual and genuine, you know? Like, I think that's part of it, is, like, there's all these little things in here that you find in, like, more elevated movies, I guess you'd say. Like, I feel like it's almost shot like a different type of film, and maybe that's part of the reason why I connected with it. It's not shot like a comedy. It's not like people pratfalling left and right, and there's not all this, like, comedy for the sake of laughter or stuff. Like, it comes from the situation and the characterization and things like that. And I just feel like other rom-coms I've watched maybe try a little too hard, whereas this one is more concerned with just telling its story. And there's something to be said about the couple not meeting until the end, and sort of, like, getting until they're at a place where they're ready to meet, and then, like, that's all it takes. And once they're together forever. But I don't know. There's just something to this one where I was willing to accept that sort of fantasy element at the end, where it's, like, right out of, you know, like an old 40s film, like they say in this movie. Whereas in other ones, I feel like they jumped the gun too quickly, or it's too crammed with disbelief or things of that nature. But I don't know. I think that's part of it, was sort of like, it felt more like a normal movie that wasn't trying to be anything else. And at the end, it revealed itself to sort of be like this rom-com to me.
So also coming out today, Fridays Are For Fun, as you know, I joined along with Jordan Pullen Clark, Kara's co-host over on Wistful Thinking. She and I were on Brian's podcast, High School Slumber Party, to talk about Tragedy Girls, a horror movie from a couple years ago. And I think that there is a sort of a tendency, and I think this also happens in music a lot, where if you see people, they're like, well, what kind of music do you like? It's like, I like anything but country and rap. It's like, well, you can't just say that. And I feel like, I mean, you can, but I don't think you can. And I feel like with both horror movies and rom-coms, I think that there is the sort of idealized version of, like, what, or not idealized version, but, like, it's the expected version of what that movie is. And I think that for both a horror movie and for a rom-com, it's not great, because there's so many that are just, it's, a lot of it is just kind of brain mush for people who like those movies, right? I think that a movie like this maybe works better because it's not that, but I also think it's an example, like, exactly an example of that. And I just don't want to, like, write off an entire genre of movies because a lot of them aren't great, because a lot of them aren't, like, they're not trying to be great. You know what I mean? They're just trying to be sweet and make you cry. Or horror movies are not trying to be great, they're just trying to be scary and make you jump or make you scream or whatever. And I think that there's a lot of similarities between the two genres, because I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, I don't like horror movies. So it's like, well, you probably do. You just don't know which ones you like. Or, like, I don't like rom-coms. Well, you probably do. You just haven't seen the ones that are more your speed. Like, It Could Happen to You, the Nicolas Cage rom-com that I adore with all of my heart. Like, that is just so wonderful. And I feel like it's similar, I think, to this. Like, that's kind of glossy and sort of not quite shot like this, but sort of, you know what I mean? Like, it's a different, it's like a more elevated take on it. And I just think that there is something nice about a movie like this that both falls into the conventions of the genre, but is also able to turn those conventions on their head to elaborate and expand upon, you know, the types of themes and tropes and characters and relationships and whatever that you normally see in a movie like this.
Yeah, I think I definitely shied away from this, or was one of the people who, like you're talking about, was like, well, I just don't like this type of movie. But I think it's something like Kara was saying earlier, like, this movie taught me how to watch these types of movies, you know? So, like, I do like these types of movies, and they're, like, going forward, like, it's just, it's they're just movies to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to categorize them anymore. Like, someone, a shelf on the rental store could categorize it for me, but as I'm watching it, I'm just going to take it, you know, on its own level and everything. And so I totally hear what you're saying between, like, the parallel between this and something like horror or something, where it's like, you can watch that just to sort of indulge in gratuitous violence or in these, you know, gratuitous, like, whatever, like, love and this and that, but that's what they're for, you know? There's a catharsis to it, and this time I definitely felt it, like, with this movie. Maybe because it's one of, just known to be one of the better ones in general, too. Like, that might have something to do with it as well, that everyone feels like it's pretty well crafted and, you know, well liked. So I don't know. I did definitely think there's hope. You know, I'm excited because there's like a whole bunch of movies now that I want to like go watch that I never considered.
And that's the best. It's like when I think the three of us on some extent, to some extent, are trying to do with Brian. It's like, no, Brian, you actually like horror movies. You just don't know it yet.
I feel that way about everyone.
Yes, exactly. But like, isn't that the best when you're able to find the movie or the actor or the director or whoever that like unlocks something? It's like, oh, wait, no, I do like this. Again, to bring it back to music, I'm not huge into country music, but because there's the Ken Burns documentary that's out right now, his telling of the history of country music, and I have one friend who is like wildly into country music now because he's into that documentary, and he's been putting together playlists, and like, all I'm listening to now is country music. And like, this is not a future that I saw for myself, but like, there's like an entryway, whether it is Johnny Cash and Coulter Wall in country music, or if it's just, you know, Nora Ephron and Meg Ryan in rom-coms, like there's a way to like get in there and just be like, oh wait, no, I was wrong. This is great.
Yeah. And I think this movie works especially well that way. I was just thinking about this, Mike, while you were talking, that because it does start so grounded in reality and so, like, and such a dismal reality, like that this little kid's mom died and now Tom Hanks has to be a single dad by himself, and then kind of like escalates slowly into magical thinking, whereas a lot of rom-coms kind of just like start out in a different universe and go from there. This kind of starts here and kind of like leads you into that magical thinking of romance.
I wonder if part of what this movie brings, because, you know, again, I'm a bit of a novice on the genre, and it is, I know it's half of the coin, it's men and women and everything, but this feels a little more male-centric than some of the other romantic comedies that I've seen, you know, like, or that I've watched lately. Is there anything to that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it shows such a different side of men in this movie, too, than you usually see at the theater.
Yeah, and I actually, one of the things that I find disappointing about this movie is that, like, the story of Tom Hanks being a single dad and, like, grappling with his grief and grappling with parenting, like, the fact that that's not the main story is frustrating to me. Like, I don't care about the romance side of it. Like, every time that he's on screen with his kid, I find it, like, so compelling and so moving. And, like, I want way more of that in this movie than there is even.
Carol, would you say that is your favorite part of the movie? Is that, you know, in terms of the favorite and least favorite moments, is it the Hanks kid stuff?
Yeah, for sure.
His kid's really good. I was shocked. Like, first of all, he looks like a normal kid, you know? Like, he almost had like a Lipnicki kind of vibe, where it's like, that kid just looks, he doesn't look like a stage actor or anything. I don't know exactly how to explain myself when I'm talking, but he just looks like someone you'd see like at any grade school, or like, it looks like one of my nephew's friends or something like that. But yeah, I thought he was great.
Did either of you recognize his, I guess, girlfriend, Jessica?
Yeah, that was Gabby Hoffman.
Yeah.
Is she from Mrs. Doubtfire?
Also, no? Yes.
But she's also, like, she's, like, an adult actress now, too. Like, she was in Girls. She's been in a bunch of indie movies. She's in a couple of movies with Michael Cera. Like, she's still working. She's still, like, a thriving actress. And the reason I was able to, like, I saw her name, I was like, that can't be the same Gabby Hoffman. Like, that's crazy. And then I saw her eyebrows, Kara, eyebrows, and I was just like, oh, no, that's Gabby Hoffman. Like, that is absolutely Gabby Hoffman.
Yeah, I mean, and she has some of the most distinctive eyebrows in Hollywood, I think. Maybe that's why I like her so much.
It might be.
But she always plays, like, real weirdos that I appreciate. And she's great in this.
Oh, she is great in this. And I feel like, it's the kind of thing, again, like, I feel not as strongly about these kids as I did about Lipnicki over in Jerry Maguire. But I feel like what they do is both annoying as hell and also works. And I don't know how it threads that needle. But, like, her doing the abbreviations, it's like, ooh, this is so annoying. Like, this is so precocious and annoying. But it kind of works, too.
Dude, that was so ahead of its fucking time. That's all kids do now, is those like LOLs and all that kind of stuff. Like, I couldn't believe that was in a movie this old. That was great. And yeah, they're kids, right? I feel like they act like kids. Like, at one moment, they're like wiser than their years. And then the next moment, they're doing like the stupidest shit that they'd get in trouble for.
And, like, thinking more about having, like, a stronger male perspective, I don't know if that's the way that you would want to phrase that, but I feel like Meg Ryan, and this also, I think, bolsters the argument that this is a ghost story and some sort of Meg Ryan is dead situation, in that, like, she's, like, a real manic pixie dream girl in this, even though she is one of the main characters. Like, she's got, like, tea bags hanging out of her pockets, and she doesn't feel, like, Tom Hanks in this feels like a real person to me, and she doesn't feel entirely grounded in reality.
Yeah, her whole side of the story, I feel, is where they're trying to sort of lighten it up a little, I guess, because obviously the Hank stuff is very, you know, it could be too dark if you just wallow there for too long.
Like, just really quickly, like, we've mentioned it, but, like, this movie, literally the first shot is him at his wife's funeral. Like, it's like, this is where we're starting.
Yeah. And, you know, I was a little worried that it was going to be too dark. But then Meg Ryan's fiance, Bill Pullman, is like the ultimate mess, right? So, like, once we got to dinner at Christmas, I was like, oh, okay, I think I get how this movie's sort of going to split itself up tonally and everything. And it's like they're going to use, like, all the Meg Ryan stuff to sort of lighten the load of all the Tom Hanks stuff. And when they sort of intersect, it's going to be like this nice happy medium kind of thing going on. That's why I figured they were really pumping up the more sort of fantasy elements and things. But I agree. I feel like they don't split the time up evenly enough, per se. Like, at some point, it like becomes Meg Ryan's movie. Or maybe it is even Meg Ryan's movie, where the focus should still feel like it's a Hanks film.
She feels like a live-action Kathy cartoon to me in this, which was like very much a vibe of the early 90s. And they actually talk a lot in this movie about that Newsweek article that came out in 1986, which we talked about on my season of Cinemakers about Amy Heckerling, because she had cited it as one of the inspirations for Look Who's Talking. But in this movie, they're talking about how Newsweek had published this article that women over 40 were more likely to be killed by a terrorist than find a husband. Like, this is a thing that actually happened and was actually, like, printed in a real magazine. In fact, the magazine that Nora Ephron started out as a male girl in the 60s, fun fact, but the terrorist statistic, like, they talk about it so much in this movie. It was like this whole big controversy, and then it was debunked, like, over and over and over again, and 20 years later Newsweek finally retracted the story. But I'm too young to remember what it was like then, but it seems like it was, like, based on the media that I've seen from that time, because it's also talked a lot about in Designing Women and, like, some other TV shows from that time and writing from that time, like, it must have been so stressful to be a woman in the early 90s, especially, like, a single woman over the age of 28. And, you know, it's definitely not at all stressful to be a woman now. So
no,
that's
definitely
good.
Not. I mean, you guys haven't made.
Yeah, come a long way.
Although I do feel like the movie does a pretty good job of also showing how it's not only tough to be a woman over 28 in 1993, but also, like, how tough it is to be just a man or anybody.
Yeah.
Rob Reiner talking to Tom Hanks about, like, well, this is how things are done. And, oh, by the way, tiramisu. Just, like, the changing landscape of things. It's the kind of things where it's like, oh, yeah, like, we could talk about, like, dating in 2019, which is going to be outdated in 3 years, probably, and let alone 26 years from now, like, when this, you know what I mean? But, like, it's always tough to be everybody. Like, just things are always tough, and things are always miserable, and everyone has, like, you know, whether you are a woman, like, this is a particularly rough time. I mean, all time is a rough time to be a woman, but also just, like, just being back out there and having to adapt to the changing society. And it's just, man, it is, this movie, I think, does a good job of making sort of everybody, the human condition is like that of a fish out of water.
Yeah. But the human condition is why rom-coms exist, and, like, why so many of them are so fluffy and ridiculous as to, like, counter the, you know, everyday horribleness of being a human in the world. Sorry.
No, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Mike, what about you? What is your favorite part of this movie? Is it something that we've already talked about, or is it something that we have not talked about?
Oh, boy, my favorite part. You know what? I love that sequence when I'm not sure if it's my favorite. I've only seen this once, but this is the moment early on where I was like, I knew I liked this movie. I didn't know I was going to love it yet, but I knew there was something different about this movie as a movie, is when Meg Ryan's driving home alone from Christmas dinner and she's listening to the radio and sort of at first she starts like singing along. What did she say?
She's just making up words like to some sort of Jingle Bells medley, and she's just singing horses, horses, horses,
that's
horses,
it, that's
horses.
It.
Horses. After horses. She turns the music off, like she just keeps singing horses, horses, horses.
Like that moment felt very real to me. But I love, because I was a little worried about how they were going to play it, and I ended up loving the sequence where she's listening to Sleepless in Seattle on the radio. Like she's listening to the radio call-in show, and the boy calls in and gets Hanks on the line, and I was like, is this sequence like ever gonna cut at any moment or anything? And it just goes on and I love it.
Yeah, because it's just her face,
and I love it. I love like the balls of just sticking with this moment and on her face like that, and like her and waiting for her reactions and everything. Like there's a real confidence to this film. Like Nora Ephron knows it feels like she's a director that knows exactly what she wants, you know, and that there's room to improvise and room to have fun, but as you know, she's got like she seems like a person with a plan and a mission and everything. And that's when I knew like there was something sort of different about this movie. And it's not the only time that like a sequence is going to do something unconventional like that, where like normally it would cut after a few minutes and go on to something else, but it's just going to keep going on or something, or change in a way you weren't expecting. Like I also feel like the montage later when Meg Ryan's following them around, like the way that ends is, you know, with her almost getting run over and stuff like that. Also, I love that moment and everything too, just in the way that it's not your everyday montage of, it's maybe it's a little stalkerish, but you know, the point is I really just like the craft of this movie, to be honest with you. It does stuff that I definitely wasn't expecting.
It's blowing my mind a little bit, Mike. What did you think about when she goes to the diner and like it seems like the entire world is listening to this mysterious radio call-in show?
Oh, I like that. You know, she goes in and the women, actually what the women are, they're talking about the guy on the radio, I think, but they're also like making reference to the guys in their lives and like what losers they are. The one woman says something about how men just will just put stuff in the refrigerator without covering it, just like puts it in there and leaves it there until it walks out on its own. That just made me laugh so hard. I just felt very like a real conversation between women, you know?
You know where it kind of gets out of hand, Joey, is like, because I like that moment too, but like later on when he gets all the fan mail and like, you know, the mailman has to like park his truck and bring all the loads. I was like, okay, that's a bit much.
It was a time before email. You had to actually physically carry it.
It was a time before email. Yeah. My mind slipped like that a few times where I was like, there's no cell phones, there's no real like the computer. There's one moment where she's like looking up stuff or trying to fax something on the computer. I was like, this is adorable.
Yeah, she was using a precursor to LexisNexis, I noticed. Like before LexisNexis even existed, she was using something to like look up that she had access to because she was a reporter. But like most people wouldn't have been able to do that at that time. And then also later in the movie when Gabby Hoffman books the little kid a ticket to New York on her own, she's like on her mom's travel agent computer doing it. But this is like technology that most people would not have access to at that time.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to and also fearing the movie that's all about computers and love in the 90s. Like it's going to be the height of everything. But what was the movie? Was it My Best Friend's Wedding? There was a Julia Roberts movie that I watched this summer where she had to send like very important emails. And I was like, oh boy, like it's the same thing. Is that how computers were? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, they were slow and hard to use.
What is my favorite moment? Oh, it's not my favorite moment, but there is in the little like gift shop outside of Meg Ryan's house or apartment or wherever she's living, and there's the heart-shaped candy box, and that's what's very clearly Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan's portrait on that. Like, I thought that was very sweet. But that's like the most, like one of the most liked trivia bits on IMDb. I was like, I thought that was obvious that it was those two. Like, do people watch this movie and not know that, you know what I'm talking about? Like that candy box?
I only know what you're talking about because in between when I watched it twice, I read the trivia and I hadn't noticed it. Like, I just hadn't even seen it the first time. So then when I saw it the second time, I was like, oh, well, that's clearly, that was just like a black silhouette cut out of the two of them.
Oh, because they transition to that scene by like showing the window, and then they zoom in on that, and they like tilt up to see Meg Ryan coming out and getting the love note from Walter, from President of the United States, Bill Pullman.
Back two in a row, yeah. Back from Gina Davis's husband in the last movie.
And Rosie's back too.
And Rosie's back as well, yeah.
I read an interview that Rosie did shortly after Nora Ephron died, and she said that it's hard for her to watch it without missing Nora Ephron a lot, and it's actually pretty painful. But she said a year before the movie was made, because she was in A League of Their Own with Madonna, it had caught the attention of Nora Ephron's then 14-year-old son, Jacob, and he kept saying, "Mom, you have to hire Rosie. She's Madonna's friend, and we can meet Madonna." So she actually credits Nora Ephron's son with getting this role in the movie because he really wanted to meet Madonna.
I love it. I think my favorite part about this movie, and again, I know that this is a Tom Hanks podcast, but again, for the second Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks thing in a row, like, I am just smitten by Meg Ryan.
She's wonderful. I mean, that's what's crazy to me is that, like, I love Tom Hanks so much in this movie. He's so good. And I love her so much in this movie. She's also great. Why don't I, it just, like, it doesn't, the two of them, well, the fact that she's, like, stalking him the whole time is weird. I mean, this is a movie about stalking, really.
But again, like, then you know what I said to myself? I could finally tell myself it's a rom-com. Like, don't think of it as stalking like you know it, you know? Like, it's fantasy stalking. We don't even use the S word.
Well, yeah, but again, this being a self-aware romantic comedy, and, like, especially Rosie saying that line about how Meg Ryan wants love to be like she's in a movie. And Jordan says this all the time on Wistful Thinking, like, this is why we're all so fucked up, is because, not this movie in particular, this, I think the fact that she's actively stalking a person and that's romantic in this movie is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but there are so many other rom-coms where the behavior is clearly crosses, like, so many lines and, like, are huge red flags for any relationship, and it's just, like, taken as part of the romance.
That's always tough. I feel like we come across that a little bit when we watch, like, older films that haven't aged well. But also there's, like, movies that I feel like don't even know they're doing that kind of thing either, you know, and kind of get away with it at times. And at least, like, I think the important thing is that, like, we as viewers can realize what's going on, you know. At least, like, if we can figure it out, then we're good on our end.
I do want to call out specifically of Meg Ryan's many wonderful things in this movie, though, you know, creepy possible stalking aside, when she sidles into Rosie's office and, like, sneaks in there and then just, like, casually, like, sideways sits down on the chair. I love that whole sequence.
Oh, there's also that time when she goes to see her brother and she's just talking and asking him questions but not giving him really an opportunity to answer. And then at one point she just, like, plonks down on the piano and it makes a noise.
Her brother, played by David Hyde Pierce, right?
It is David Hyde Pierce, yeah. I got him confused with the guy from the Titanic who is married to Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks' real-life wife who plays his sister in this movie.
That's so weird. This is like the third or fourth movie she's been in, too. I was surprised she wasn't trying to sell us a Coca-Cola, Joey.
Oh, man. Yeah, I didn't know she was in this one. Like, I know that, and she's going to be back in five movies
for
That
Thing
You
do,
right?
Yeah,
so.
She may even pop up before then. Who knows?
Maybe. I don't know. We will certainly find out. I just love Meg Ryan. I just love her, like, just the physicality of it all. You know, she's just, like, she's able to convey being sweet, but also crafty and smart and innocent and, like.
I mean, she's the perfect rom-com star. Like, there's a reason why she was in so many of these movies, and it's because she's perfect.
Yeah, no arguments here. Is there anything else? Like, her just sitting in the closet, listening to the radio, like, just trapped in there? Like,
oh, I did have one other favorite moment that I at first was mad about and then really enjoyed, which is the food allergy scene from early in the movie when they, like, go to Meg Ryan's family's house and Bill Pullman is meeting her family for the first time, ? And also they're announcing they're engaged. That seems like a high-stakes situation, but...
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, he's memorizing all the names and what they do, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, going into that, one of them, he mentions somebody's wife, and she's like, that's the one with red hair. She's the most competitive woman in the world. And then he starts having an allergic reaction to something, and then that woman starts talking about how her husband is allergic to bees, and how he's just so allergic to bees, and kind of doing this kind of one-upmanship where they're talking about allergies and stuff, which is played as a joke, but also I've been in that situation so many times where, like, that actually, even though it is like a source of the comedy in the scene, it felt very real to me, a person with food allergies, because it's like funny and awkward and uncomfortable, and people say weird things to you, and I've been like in very similar situations to that.
I got so thrown off guard of the Bill Pullman character, and I wondered, you know, I mean I clearly think it was an intentional thing, like, you know, he's very handsome, he's very dashing, and you see him instantly and he's like memorizing all these facts about her family and everything. You're like, all right, this guy's fucking got it together, like, you know, like
he's a real total catch package.
Yeah, he's a real catch. And then the very next scene or two, like, it all falls apart. It's like he's a mess, like he can't hold it together. He's got no idea what to do. But he ends up being like the sweetest guy in the world at the end when they break off the engagement.
He takes the breakup like a champ. He's just like, yes, go be with a man who you don't know, but you love. I'm okay with that.
I love the whole, I mean, I was just so thrown by him at first. So I love the portrayal of Bill Pullman's character in this movie.
I still think he's a real catch regardless.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good-looking dude. He's probably got a good job. He's got a beautiful ring. He's got a family, like a mother who's like, who loves him enough to give him the ring, like, you know.
Yeah, but the movie is trying to say, like, and I mean, not just with the food allergy stuff. I think that's like shorthand to be like, oh, like he's not what you thought he was, or like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's something behind that facade that it's kind of cracked. I don't know. I was just, you know, he's not exactly what she thought he was. Is the kind of thing going on there?
No, I feel like she knows exactly who he is, and that's what she thinks she loves about him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, these are all just aspects of his life and his personality, and it's like she is delusional, basically. Well, because like her mother says something when she's like trying on her great grandmother's wedding gown or whatever, that like she felt magic when she saw her husband for the first time, and like it seems like it. I don't know if maybe Meg Ryan's character had been thinking about this previously, or maybe it was just, you know, swirling in the back of her head. But like in the world of this movie, it seems like that plants the seed that then grows into this full-blown obsession with a man she doesn't know. You know what I mean? That like she's like, magic? I've never once considered this before. What's that? What's that like? That's not what this is, you know? And so, you know, it's all like very normal stuff, I think, that people go through before making a lifelong commitment. But like, there's nothing wrong with that guy. He seems great.
Because it's like he says at the end something, he's like, I don't want you to settle, right? Like, he's, yeah, like, don't just settle for me if it's not what you like figured out, it's not what you want, you know? So yeah, it's something that's interesting. Yeah, so she loves him for all of his flaws and foibles and all that kind of stuff in the beginning and everything.
Yeah, which is like good. You're supposed to. I would hope that you would if you're gonna like be married to somebody forever, you know what I mean? But like those are somehow drawbacks. Like when she starts like entering this like realm of magical thinking, for some reason, like, you know, all of these things that had previously been strengths are now weaknesses, or at least she is seeing them that way.
Now, Kara, is there something about this movie that doesn't work for you, or is there something that you would change or you would remove?
I mean, the whole thing? I don't know. I can't quite put my finger on what it is about this that I don't like and that isn't working, because it's like, I love Nora Ephron. I love the people in this movie. I get what they're trying to do, and it just doesn't work for me, and I don't quite sure know why. Also, like, I have a nostalgic attachment to When Harry Met Sally, which is a movie that certainly has its problems, but also it's perfect. And so, like, to come back to this after seeing the other one so many times, and the fact that Meg Ryan is in both of them, maybe it was just a letdown. And the first time I watched it, I was in a very bad mood, which was why I watched it again. And I'm glad that I did, because I enjoyed it a lot more the second time. But I don't know.
It sort of makes me wonder, you know, when watching it a second time and liking it more, but not necessarily still clicking in or not really fully understanding it. And I wonder if this is the kind of movie that if you could watch it another time, another two times or three times or five times or whatever, if you're going to get to that point where you're like, oh, I love this movie unabashedly.
Sure. I mean, I honestly think if you watch a movie enough times, like, you're going to fall in love with it, whether you like it or not. Yeah.
You'll Stockholm yourself, right? You'll just, like, break your spirit down and be like, oh, no, I love this movie.
Yeah. You'll find things to love about it. And there are things that I love about this.
that I do wonder in that regard, you know, this is a podcast about Tom Hanks, and, you know, not that we're not necessarily Tom Hanks experts, we just, you know, do a lot of podcasts and whatever, but I wonder, you know, somebody stumbles across this episode because they're like, oh, I love, like, Sleepless in Seattle is my favorite movie, and then they hear all three of us are like, yeah, I've never seen it before, this is the first time, here's my thoughts on it. It's just like, are we doing it the right way? You know, like, I feel like it's kind of a weird thing that we do for the podcast, where just like, unlike your show, Kara, where you, in theory, the at least the thesis statement of your show is like a movie that you saw probably a bunch growing up that you like, that you're going to rewatch. Like, at least you sort of have a film, like, you know what it is. Here, I feel like it's just a different thing. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, nostalgia is a hell of a drug. You know what I mean? Like, so when you have some sort of emotional attachment to something, it's going to change how you feel about that thing. You're going to feel differently at different points in your life because you're going through different things or you've had different experiences. And so revisiting something now has like a certain resonance. But so this is why it's kind of silly to me that people think that you can objectively evaluate a movie or anything really, because like these things are so subjective. Like the mood that you're in affects how you feel about the movie. Like there's all of these little things. You go see it in the movie theater and like the person in front of you is texting, like that yep. can mm-hmm. totally throw off your experience of a movie.
I was thinking as you were talking about that, about like just like the mindset, the mentality of, you know, the circumstances in which you see a movie. Like, not to plug High School Summer Party again, but when you were just on talking about Buffy and you were talking about how you had seen Buffy the show in its entirety in three different, wildly different times in your life.
And so different.
Everything,
yeah.
like anything you do or watch or like, you know, watch or read or consume, like it's just going to hit you differently. I feel like in terms of books, like I read so many of like the greatest books of all time in high school and college because like they were assigned to me. And I was like, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. I was just like a dumb kid. Like, why am I reading like Shakespeare? Or like, I know that why we do it, but like, what are we, like, we're not supposed to, like, what do we get from that? Like, we're just dumb kids with no experience.
Yeah.
I wonder if that speaks to why I might have liked this, because I don't really have like anything, like I had really low expectations going in originally no matter what, and like I feel like it aged pretty well all things considered.
Yeah.
And I just have to imagine that when it came out in its time, it was probably like explosive, like so of its time. And mm-hmm. so I think that's part of it. I think just movies are made for when they're made, like they just are from a certain time. And this one though, like I don't know, there's just some lasting, there's some like everlasting like qualities to it. I feel that just, it's not like super crass or mean or anything. It never gets too dark, and it treads like so well on real moments, like when he's talking to his son about sex just so candidly and all that kind of stuff. Like all that stuff like really matters and means that, and it's all those little touches that sort of make it stand apart. And so like for me, I think that's why it worked for me, because I didn't really have anything to compare it to necessarily to say like, oh, here's what I like, I hope it's like that, or I hope it's as good as that or this or whatever. I just kind of didn't like anything before this one, and now it's what I'm going to use to sort of, it's my litmus test one now.
Well, if those are things that you enjoyed about this movie, I highly recommend getting into Nora Ephron's other work, because that's exactly what her writing is like. It's always so smart and timely, but timeless. And like, you know, cheeky, but never too mean. I guess, like, I don't love all of her movies. I love When Harry Met Sally and Julia, and that's kind of it. But I have read like almost all of her books and her essays and stuff, and they're all just so wonderful. So just want to make another plug for Nora Ephron, if that's what you liked about this movie.
Well, Mike, what did you not like about this movie? What would you change? What was your least favorite part of this?
Okay. I actually feel like this wraps up too quickly. Like, it sort of feels like it makes a sharp left turn when he goes to New York, when the kid just, like, books the flight and takes off on his own. I don't know what I want, what else I want there. I think maybe I want more Lost in New York or something.
Yeah, it was in the early 90s. New York was still very scary for a tiny child.
Yeah, and all the cab drivers are like, where to, little guy? What, are you going to spit off the top of the Empire State Building? Good for you. But I don't know, I feel like it sort of just sprints to the end at some point. Like, it just sounds like a gunshot went off and we have to finish this movie now. I don't know whether or not that's what's going on, but that's just how it feels to me. It just kind of feels like at a certain moment, this movie is just racing to the finish line. And I just wish it didn't. I wish it kind of skipped there or galloped or something like that. But, you know, everyone's in this big panic because the boy, like, went to New York on his own, and rightfully everyone should be in a panic about that. I'm not saying they shouldn't. I just wish there was something else going on maybe before that, or you know, when he gets to New York, and I don't know what to do, but it's just like a feeling, you know, I'll just say it one more time. I just feel like it speedily wraps itself up a little too quickly. I wish it just sort of like floated there a little more.
Like, do you wish that it had more time with them together, or you want the build up to them getting together is longer?
I think I need a little of both. Like, we get her with Bill Pullman having that nice dinner, and that's great. But Hanks doesn't really, we have one shot of him like on the airplane and then racing to get, like, I don't know what, maybe he needed to go with more people. And yeah, and I definitely wanted, you know, I don't need to follow them down in the elevator, but I would have liked like an extra couple minutes of them just like sort of staring into each other's eyes.
No, but that would ruin it.
No, I mean, they don't have to say anything, but I just want him to be standing there sort of dumbstruck an extra minute or two. Again, like, there's no way I could ever write anything like Nora Ephron can or any, so I don't want to, like, I don't even know what to do different, but I just, it's a, you know, it's just a feeling I had where I was like, I don't want this to wrap up as fast as it is. I feel like there's a slower way to do this. But
I like that it ends so abruptly. Like, I definitely do want some Lost in New York action with that kid, because that kid is, like, amazing. And I feel like he should be in this movie a little bit more.
Wait, hold on, real quick. What if, Mike, the kid Lost in New York, we give Kara exactly what she wants, and this kid, like, wanders off, goes down in the subways, finds Pardue, a holy man down there. Right? What if that happens?
Oh, dude, and instead of the top of the Empire State Building, they go to the top of the World Trade Center where Pardue wanted to go.
Also, I want to point out that this is a gross exaggeration. I was going to say my entire life, I always heard that this movie ended on the top of the Empire State Building. And in my head, I was like, everybody's got to be wrong. Why would it be called Sleepless in Seattle and it's not in the Space Needle? Like, why, how, like, this shit makes no sense. Like, it's romantic, but it's just like, they're in another city with another tall, famous, pointy building. Like, why would you not do that?
The whole geography of this had me real confused.
Oh, maybe that's what I don't... Maybe if they stayed in Seattle at the end. Maybe going to New York was the problem for me.
I didn't even know she was from Baltimore. I thought she was from Chicago. And I was like, oh, this makes sense because he's originally from Chicago. He'll just go back to Chicago. No, like, she's from Baltimore. They wind up in New York. But at the same time, now that I'm thinking about it, this is actually hilarious and kind of adds another layer of comedy to this that I hadn't previously thought about. Like, just the logistics of it is absolute nonsense. Like, the reason that it is New York and the reason that it is the Empire State Building is because that is what is in An Affair to Remember. They're watching it, and Rosie just gives her that as a time and place to meet the guy.
Quick question, speaking about geography, what did you guys think of having, or what did you think of having the school classroom map pull down on the wall that they have installed in their home?
You know, that is weird that it's installed in the house, but I loved how throughout the entire movie we were getting a geography lesson. Like, what city, what state is that in? And the kid, like, wouldn't know, and Hanks would be like, ha-ha, and, like, point to it on the map.
Yeah, and we actually, like, see the map and the animations and the traveling and stuff. I guess I hadn't thought about the geography as a part of the movie, really, but it is. Which made me just think of a really wonderful rom-com that I'm going to recommend. One of the many wonderful rom-coms starring Drew Barrymore, who is also a perfect rom-com actress. Oh, well, Music and Lyrics is great. That one is one of my very favorites, but that's not what I was thinking about. Going the Distance, it's like her and the guy from the Apple commercials, the Mac guy.
Justin Long?
They have this like long distance relationship, and it's
I think
so
Christina
good.
Applegate's in it as her sister-in-law or sister
yes.
or something.
Okay. Yeah, highly recommend.
I've seen this movie as well. I apparently I've logged it on Letterboxd. I don't know why I've seen this or when I saw it.
I've seen it like an embarrassing number of times. Music and Lyrics also. That one's with Hugh Grant, and he plays like a former pop star. Like, he was in like a Depeche Mode type band.
I've almost certainly seen it because Charlie Day is in it, and also like there's just like a stacked cast of, like you said, Christina Applegate, but also Charlie Day and Jason Sudeikis and Ron Livingston. Natalie Morales is wonderful. Jim Gaffigan, June Diane Raphael, Rob Riggle, Sarah Burns, Mike Birbiglia. Like, this is certainly Kristen Schaal's in here somewhere. Yeah, like, it's definitely a movie that I would have seen, I think, probably just because it was Charlie and stuff. But yeah, wow, okay. But you recommended it, Kyra? You love that one?
Highly. Yeah.
I'm going to say, I think I mentioned it earlier, my least favorite part of Sleepless in Seattle is just the precociousness of the kids. Doesn't work for me.
Really?
It just doesn't.
I
no, it doesn't.
I love it.
I like parts of it. I don't, there's things I like and there's things I don't like. I think the kid Jonah's, I like his steadfastness to Annie. I just think that there's certain bits that are just, it just doesn't feel real. Like just him talking to Hanks, like, so you're going to have sex with this woman, right? Or like, you know, just like stuff like that. Just like,
I love that stuff. I feel like, because I love how Hanks as a dad doesn't like shy away from any of that. He's like, this is my son. He's going to be a man one day. Like, I'm just going to give it to him straight kind of talk.
And it's the movie starts that way. He's just like very matter of factly explaining, like, your mom got sick and she died, and like, this is just the way that things are, you know? So like, it establishes it from the very beginning of the movie that they have a very like frank and honest relationship with each other.
But I can see some of that going, like getting to you a little bit. Like, where it got to me sort of was, I guess when he, and maybe because he started acting like such a child of like the age he was supposed to be, but like when Hanks is dating that one woman that he doesn't like, you know, because he wants him to go to see Annie and stuff, and he's like mocking her, he'd be like, thank you very much, and like all that kind of shit, and it's just like, oh, you little...
Yeah, but like, that's how kids process this kind of stuff, you know? Like, they don't have... I mean, most adults don't have the tools to deal with this situation, you know? So I found, like, the characterization of those kids and the acting of those kids, like, so spot on. I also just, like, really enjoy children of that age. Like, I do not like kids, but, like, third graders are hilarious. And they're just, like, you know, like, the world hasn't quite beaten them down yet, but they're just a little too smart for their own good.
Can we talk about very briefly why Meg Ryan hires a detective to take pictures of Tom Hanks in Seattle while he's on a date?
Oh, it's because she's stalking him.
Yeah, that seems crazy.
Joey, what if she hired Cage from the beginning of Honeymoon in Vegas? Because that was his job. Remember, as like a PI to do that kind of thing? Part of me just thought, I was like, oh, I really feel like that almost like was supposed to be cut, or there was something more there that got edited out. And I actually kind of feel like once or twice in the beginning of this movie that like a lot of stuff might have gotten sort of cut out of the beginning of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm fine with all that. But that to me felt like sort of a residual sort of leftover thing that, like, not that it wasn't supposed to be there, but like there's used to be a lot more going on with that is how it felt.
Well, it gives her a photograph of what he looks like, because you couldn't just look up what people looked like back then. And then the only like thing that it really sets up is the triangle hair. Both the woman that he's dating and Rita Wilson's character have like very similarly shaped curly bobs that are like from behind just look like a triangle. So in the photos that the private detective takes, it's like the back of the woman that he's dating, her head, and then when she sees them in the street, she sees Rita Wilson from behind and thinks it's the same person. So when she very warmly greets the child and Tom Hanks, she's like, oh wow, look, they're in a relationship. I'm too late.
I understand the coincidence of that and why that works narratively, but I also feel like if you get a halfway decent detective, they're going to get pictures of her too. Like, it's not gonna be like, oh, I can't see her from this angle, like, that's, I'm good.
You guys, we're talking about film photography, okay? You had to have actual film in the camera, you had to get it developed.
So here are some quick bits of trivia. Originally, Annie, the role of Meg Ryan, was offered to Julia Roberts herself, who turned it down. Kim Basinger was also offered the role, but thought the premise was, quote, ridiculous. Michelle Pfeiffer, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Jodie Foster all declined. Meg Ryan then landed the role. Also considered Nicole Kidman, Demi Moore, and Natasha Richardson.
She has real Kidman energy in this. I could totally see Nicole Kidman in this.
It feels like a lot of these names, Nicole Kidman included, and Michelle Pfeiffer, I think, and Jennifer Jason Leigh, sort of are popping up in, like, kind of how Cage and Cruise are every role that went to Cruise, that Cage was considered for or whatever. It feels like all of these women are basically considered for all of these movies around this time, both, like, the Cruise movies and the Hanks movies that we're covering. Like, these are just like, hey, this is who was hot at the time, and, like, we're gonna get him in our movies. But again, I just think that, you know, Meg Ryan is just so wonderful here that I'm glad it was her. Do either of you want to play the game in which you win a walk-on role into Sleepless in Seattle? Where would you put yourself? Would you be atop the Empire State Building looking out? Kara, would you be a woman standing there and have Jonah say, are you Annie? And you say, no, no, dear. Where would you put yourself in this movie? Or do you not want to be in this movie?
No, I would be probably in the diner.
Hmm. Okay, yeah.
The only role I think I could play in this is that 90-year-old elevator character. It's the only age-appropriate role.
Age you up just a little bit, not too much. Yeah, you're almost there. Almost there.
You know, I found it so striking how young they were in this movie. I don't know, like, how old the characters themselves are supposed to be, but Hanks was 35 when he made this, uh-huh. or at least when it came out. And the woman that he's dating, that actress, was 26. But I think her hair makes her look really old. And the clothes, like, the early 90s was still, like, very shoulder paddy, but, like, a little looser than the late 80s. So, like, a lot of draping, which I think... You know, no one's really showing off the figure. It can kind of make you look a little more matronly.
He's wearing very billowy shirts, too. Like, when he is just, like, making that phone call to that woman, he's, like, wearing, like, shirt that, like, you can't see where his arm begins or ends. It's just, like, it's basically like a puffy shirt. I looked up Clarice, who plays, because, again, just, I can't think of the name Clarice and not think of Starling. But the babysitter, Clarice, this is the only thing she's ever done. Like, she's got to just be, like, the daughter or the friend of someone. Now, can we imagine... for a minute, Sleepless in Seattle, starring Tom Cruise in the Tom Hanks role as a dad. We saw him in Jerry Maguire sort of as a father figure. What would this movie be like with Tom Cruise in the role, or if not the Tom Hanks part, is there another role? And I don't know that there is another. I mean, there's the Rob Reiner role, there's the brother-in-law role. If Tom Cruise doesn't work in this role, where could he be in this movie?
Could he play Bill Pullman?
Mm.
I actually think he would work in this, to be quite honest. I think... Joey, from what we've seen, even though he hasn't shown quite the vulnerability to the level that Hanks gets to in this movie. And by the way, I'm just blown away by what Hanks is able to do in this movie. Like, I fucking feel for the guy so much. Like, the moment when the actual ghost of his wife visits him in this movie, and I just fucking lost it so hard. That was one of the scenes where it was just, like, over for me. But I could totally... I think I could see Tom... I think this would be a good vehicle for Tom Cruise, believe it or not. Like, I think... But I think he's got it. I think there's something about this material that he would fit. I would love to see him as a single father. I think he would have that sort of air to him that he's sort of lost without, you know, without his wife in his life.
Now, would his wife be dead, or did he just steal the children from his wife?
Too close to life.
That I'm not sure. But I'm going to have to say this time, like, I'm pretty sure he could do this one.
Kara, what about you? Do you think that it could be Tom Cruise in the role or no?
I think he could do it. I would have a hard time liking it. And just, I mean, Hanks, so I looked up also the ages of his kids, and his eldest son, Colin Hanks, who we now know mm-hmm. as an actor as well, was about 14 when this came out. So, okay. Like, he, by then, when I was watching him with that kid in that movie, it looked like he was having a conversation with his, like, actual son. Like, it felt so real to me in a way that, like, I don't think that Tom Cruise is capable of. Like, because he always is, like, a little bit plastic to me. And I was actually really kind of blown away with, like, how genuine Hanks felt in this. I think I would instead cast him as the brother-in-law, because I could see them doing like an improv shtick like they do with, you know, talking about that war movie whose name I can't remember.
Dirty Dozen.
There you go. Like, I could see the two of them kind of like bouncing off of each other. Maybe the Rob Reiner role. But I think Rob Reiner is perfect.
I think, actually, you know, I agree that Rob Reiner is perfect. And I don't want to. Like, I think you could put him in that kind of role. But I think it would be a different, I think an equally funny but a different tone. Like, you have this, like, again, comparing Cruise to Hanks and whatever. But, like, you have this, like, young, sexy stud in Tom Cruise. And, like, trying to explain, like, not just, like, the dating element, but, like, more of, like, the sex element. And, like, you're never going to believe, like, what they're into now. Like, you know what I mean? Just, like, the kind of, like, almost like in The Wolf of Wall Street, where they're talking about, like, what prostitutes do to, you know what I mean? Like, they're having that conversation. Like, is that also with Rob Reiner?
Mm-hmm.
So, weird coincidence there. But, like... It just, I feel like it would be like the same kind of like, let me tell you the ins and outs and whatever, but it wouldn't be the like the dating element, like, oh, you don't pay for this, she doesn't pay for that, whatever. It's more of the like disgusting sort of dirty, not sure if it fits in this movie, but I could definitely see in that kind of role, that kind of advice that he could give.
I could see that, but I love Rob Reiner's
role. I do
too. His line about the butts, cute butts. Which sounded probably improvised also when he's talking about how all women want these days are like good pecs and cute butts, and it made me laugh. And I can't, I mean, obviously Tom Cruise wouldn't say that because I'm sure his butt is very cute. Can't confirm though, never really paid attention.
The answer to this is, I think, very obviously a yes, but does Tom Hanks in this movie do anything that sets him on the road to becoming America's dad?
The very first thing I wrote down was, America's dad! Exclamation point.
So, yes.
This might be where that started, maybe? Like, could this possibly be, like, part of the genesis of why he's called America's dad? Is because he's, like, one of the ultimate dads ever in this
possibly.
Movie?
Yeah,
possibly.
I think so.
This movie was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, Best Original Screenplay and Best Original Song. Did not win either of those.
Whoa, what song?
Oh my god, the epic Celine Dion cover of, what was it, something?
It was nominated for A Wink and a Smile.
Hmm.
Music by Mark Shaiman, lyrics by Ramsey McLean.
You mean it wasn't the Celine Dion song?
Also this year, also nominated for Best Academy Award for Original Screenplay, Philadelphia. They both lost to The Piano, written by Jane Campion. Golden Globes nominated for Best Motion Picture Comedy or Musical, Best Performance in a Music or Motion Picture Comedy or Musical for Meg Ryan and for Tom Hanks. So all three the film, and each of them got a nomination. None of them won either, though, unfortunately. So. But talking about some awards they could win, let's nominate this for some Woodies, the Tom Hanks Awards. We already have Meg Ryan nominated for Best Non-Hanks Actor Female for her oeuvre, her 3-film arc, her 5 different characters that she plays. I'm hesitant to ask this because I don't think it belongs there, but Best Film, question mark? Knowing what's coming.
I know you keep saying that every episode, knowing what's coming. I know some of the stuff that's coming, and I really want to say yes, but...
Like, I'm just trying to think rationally about if we have 10 movies, right? Probably, and I don't want to, like, get ahead of ourselves, but probably Catch Me If You Can, Saving Private Ryan, The Green Mile, Forrest Gump,
well,
Philadelphia.
I'm not
I don't
so
like
sure
Forrest
about,
Gump. I know that,
I'm
I know,
not
I don't
so
like,
sure
I don't
about
like
that anymore.
But yes, but the 5 of those, at least 2 Toy Stories, maybe? A League of Their Own is better, Joe vs. the Volcano.
I mean, you make a compelling argument.
It's on the cusp. I'll put it in. It's on, because I like it more than The Money Pit, which we have on here.
Okay, yeah, maybe just swap it off with The Money Pit tonight.
Nah, I'll just leave it there. We'll call it down in late December 2020.
Because, Joey, I mean, I feel like my catchphrase for Tom Club is, nobody's more surprised than me. Like, I've said it so many times on, like, recent episodes where I was like, no one's more surprised than I am that I actually like this movie or whatever, like, that I don't like this or whatever. And it happened again tonight. It's weird.
Amazing.
It's a
Amazing.
Weird feeling. So weird.
Do we want to nominate Sam Baldwin as one of the best Hanks roles?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because this is, like I said, I feel like this is proto-dad. Like, this is the dad that they talk about when he's becoming America's dad.
I want to give this movie credit for Best Ensemble. I feel like we have to, because everybody in this movie plays their part exceptionally well. Best Fight? He doesn't get into a fight, right?
No, no fights.
Best Dance Scene, Best Party Scene, Best Outfit Wardrobe, all no. Does Not Die. Best Line or Best Freakout? Is there something that he says that we want to nominate for Best Line or Best Freakout?
Oh, he actually has a lot of really good lines in this. I didn't write any of them down.
He has this line. I actually have heard this in a couple other movies. I mean, I don't think it's because of this movie or whatever. I mean, maybe. But, like, it's a line that I've... That's just come up a lot. And so, like, when he's talking... When he's asked about his wife that passed away, like, what was it about your wife that you couldn't live without her, that you love so much, this and that. And I feel, at one point he says she felt like home, like, I knew I was home or something like that. And, like, that has come up, like, a lot lately in stuff that I've watched. And so, like, I perked up and paid attention. I was like, holy shit, is this sort of like where that came from, that line that, like, loving you is like being home, or like feeling like I'm at home or something like that or whatever. I'm not saying we need to nominate it. I'm just saying, like, as far as like dialogue and lines in this movie, that jumped right out at me.
I thought you were going to say, when you started that description, the what I thought was a very sweet line that he says is when he's on the phone with the call-in show. And she says, tell me about your wife. And he says, well, how long is your show? Like, basically, how long do you want me to talk for? Because I
can I just
forever.
Read the whole passage?
Absolutely.
So this is actually, it's such a short clip, but it's, I think there are, like, so many good lines right in here, which is the psychologist says, people who truly loved once are far more likely to love again. Sam, do you think that there's someone out there who you could love as much as your wife? And then he says, well, that's hard to imagine. And she asks him, what are you going to do? And he says, well, I'm going to get out of bed every morning, breathe in and out all day long. Then after a while, I won't have to remind myself to get out of bed every morning and breathe in and out. And then after a while, I won't have to think about how I had it great and perfect for a while. And then she asks to tell her what was so special about his wife. And he says, well, how long is your program? It's a million tiny things that when you add them all up, they meant we were supposed to be together. Which, side note, I feel like we see that illustrated like over the course of the movie, like these like parallels between these two characters that like taken alone don't really mean anything, but they, you know, cumulatively by the end of the movie, you actually are rooting for the two of them. And side note. And then he says, I knew it the very first time I touched her, it was like coming home, only to no home I had ever known. I was just taking her hand to help her out of a car, and I knew it was like magic. So I think not necessarily a line, but a short excerpt, maybe.
I like all of that. I think that it's all beautifully delivered. I guess we'll just say radio monologue.
Sure. Yeah, that works.
I do like that there is the thing that, again, it's another trivia on IMDb. I feel like it's just the kind of thing that you would pick up maybe, but early in the movie as Meg Ryan, I think it's maybe the second time that she's listening on the radio and she's carving an apple and she's doing the entire peel with the one slice through. And then when Tom Hanks is explaining or describing his wife to his son, or he's saying, you know, what did you love about her or whatever, like that's the thing he says, like she can do that. And I feel like that's the kind of thing, it's the, you know, she's the replacement or whatever. Mike, I'm gonna this is not necessarily a good movie, but have you seen the movie Return to Me starring David Duchovny and Minnie Driver?
No, I have not.
The movie is about David Duchovny is a widower. His wife dies. Oh, also, by the way, as a journalism nerd, I loved Meg Ryan's, why, if you're a widower, do you get widowed? Why are you not widowered? Which I love. But Return to Me is about David Duchovny's wife dies and like in a car accident, and her heart is transplanted into Minnie Driver's body. And then, you know, he is attracted to her. And it's basically...
Wait, I've all the questions already. Oh my god.
And then they fall, a spoiler, but of course, there's no way that it doesn't end with that, but they fall in love because, like, her heart returned to him.
Oh my god, thank god that she wasn't, like, a murderer and that the heart transplant didn't turn Minnie Driver into a crazed lunatic.
But that's the kind of thing where it's like, it's not like, and I don't remember the actress's name who plays his wife, because she's in a couple scenes in this movie, but it's not like her spirit went into Meg Ryan. It's not like she became Annie. It's the same, you know, they both existed at the same time, but it does kind of feel like, in a way, she's kind of the reincarnation, or similar enough, right? Where it's just like, oh, that they're... But again, that's also kind of worrying, like, do you want to replace your love with the same person? Like, it feels like then there would be this kind of ideal that you can't live up to.
Is that like replacing the turtle when it dies before your kid finds out? No, but he definitely has, like, a type. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
a woman who can carve an entire apple with a single cut.
All I was thinking when I was watching that the first time was, like, how many takes did this take? Because she doesn't even do the whole apple. Like, it falls apart at some point.
All right, so best line we have that. Best soundtrack, theme, score? No?
There's so many songs in this movie. Apparently the person that they had originally hired to do the music in this, like, they gave him a list of 20 something songs that they really wanted in the movie, and he quit. He was like, we can't do this. And there are like so many kind of like crooner style songs and like old Hollywood romantic comedy songs in this that I found it kind of obnoxious, but I think it was just kind of like trying to conjure those like feelings of like those old Hollywood kind of love stories, but I didn't really appreciate it.
Best or worst Hanks love story? I'm gonna say no. Because, like, it's not a love story. It's an obsessive stalker story. Most badass role, not for Hanks. And then best non-Hanks actor, male or female, we already have Meg Ryan. Is there anybody else we want to nominate? I'm going to say no, just because I think this is, like, a two-handed show, right? Like,
I think the little kid. I think he's so good in this.
I like the kid, too, but I think we already have Lipnicki on the list, don't we? I like him.
Other show. Other podcast.
Oh, other podcast. Oh, okay, then. Never mind. I'm sorry.
Well, you need a Lipnicki of your own for this one.
I'll say Ross Mullinger as Jonah.
Yeah, he didn't wind up doing much. He was in like a few other big movies as a little kid and did a voice on a cartoon that I loved called Recess, which was on like ABC Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Spinelli is like probably a much bigger influence on my life than I realized. But yeah, he was just like one of the other characters on that show. And then I couldn't really find what he was up to now.
We have 6 nominations here. Best film, best role, best ensemble, best line, and then best non-Hanks actor, male and female, for The Son and for Meg Ryan.
Cool. Nice.
Any other final thoughts about Sleepless in Seattle before we come back in 2 weeks for Philadelphia, a movie that, we're going to talk about it.
My final thought about Sleepless in Seattle is, you know, now that I think about it, I understand why they didn't, and I like this ending very much, but I totally think it could have ended at the Space Needle and been very, very romantic and maybe carved out even more of its own niche in the genre by not sort of repeating what was done in a very famous movie. It still works extremely well for me, but I could see it working that way too. And maybe that's the way I would fix it when I was complaining earlier on.
Like, so you're saying that she picks up the backpack, she looks at the teddy bear, she turns around and she sees them, or we see from their back, they see her, and then it just ends?
No, she never comes back from, like, Seattle. Like, that's what I'm thinking is, like, she stays there and, like, starts, like, talking to them, and they meet at the Space Needle or some kind of chain of events where, like, she goes back to Seattle and they do it all there.
It's okay.
A little, I don't know, I feel like it's a little cleaner. It keeps it all in Seattle. But that's it. You know, ultimately, it doesn't really make a difference. I love this movie. I was not expecting to. No one's more surprised than I am.
Well, for what it's worth, I think I read that they shot the Empire State Building stuff in Seattle. So they shot all of that, was all shot out there. So, Kara, any other final thoughts about Sleepless in Seattle?
Two very important things. One is Meg Ryan's fishtail braid, which was a very popular hairstyle in the 90s. It's a little bit different than a regular braid. It's more intricate because there's like more strands that you weave together. And then hers is like all loose. So I just wanted to point that out. Fishtail braid. We should bring those back. And there are so many bad flower arrangements in this movie. I don't understand what's going on with these flowers. They're crazy looking.
Like real flowers or fake flowers?
Yeah, the real flowers.
Poorly arranged.
Poorly arranged. And not even like, so when a lot of people, when they get flowers, they get home and they just plonk them in a vase. And they're like, I got some flowers. But really what you should do is you should give them a fresh cut. You should like arrange them nicely, because the way that it's tied together for the bouquet isn't necessarily going to translate really well into the vase. And also you want to use a vase that's like the right height for the stem length that you got and the fullness of the bouquet. Anyway, all of these things are not happening in this movie. Like they're in the wrong sized vessels, but then also like there's one on her desk that is just, you guys, I don't know what's happening. I just found it so distracting and upsetting, and I could not let this episode end before mentioning it.
Well, I appreciate your commitment to the Flower Report, both on Instagram and in film, so thank mm-hmm. you.
You know, and I did, last night when I was watching this, I was watching the credits, and I clocked whoever the greens person was on this movie, and I didn't write it down, and I should have, because I need to call them out. That was a bad
yeah,
greens.
I mean, this is a professional Hollywood film with, like, yeah. you know, real actors, and I'm sure they got great catering.
I am wondering now if, and I'm just spitballing here, but if, like, the bad flower arrangements were on purpose, like, purposely kind of subverting the conventions of the rom-com, like, just in the set dressing, because now that I'm thinking about it, like, there are always lots of beautiful flowers in romantic comedies, and I'm thinking, like, maybe they were like, let's make the flowers bad.
I mean, it could be.
An interesting choice.
Subconsciously, you know, just affecting you as you're watching it.
Well, let's chalk it up to that. Well, Kara, you have wistful thinking. Yesterday, you just put out your third and final spooky October movie, Idle Hands. What do you have planned? Do you know what you have planned yet for November?
No, we don't.
Well, every other Thursday, you can learn alongside all of us as Kara and Jordan go back into the childhood memories, go back to the age when they were Jonah, and, you know, just listening to Beatles records backwards. Is that as good all grown up? And then, Mike, you have a new episode coming out of your show on Sunday. What's your November 3rd episode?
Oh, that's right. So we're going to Hogwarts this fall, and we're going to be checking out The Prisoner of Azkaban over at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. So
Alfonso Cuarón.
Definitely going to have one guest for that show. Hopefully going to have two guests for that show. So stay tuned and check it out.
Including one that hopefully enjoyed our dissection of one of her favorite movies in this episode. She shall remain nameless, but you know,
shall remain nameless, but I'm hoping to get a real Harry Potter expert consultant on that program, so fingers crossed.
Well, Kyra, thank you so much for joining us. You'll be back before too long on a couple of these episodes. I don't know when, but you can also check out Kyra on our Too Fast, Too Forever lap, this entire lap, watching all of the Fast and Furious movies for the very first time. This upcoming Tuesday the 5th, you will be talking about Fast and Furious number 4 from 2009. So get excited. And again, Kyra, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
For all things Hanks for the Memories, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, hanks@cageclub.me. Come back in 2 weeks for Philadelphia, Hanks' first of two, I want to say, Best Actor Oscar Academy Award wins back-to-back, that and Forrest Gump, so that's going to be very exciting. So come back in 2 weeks for that. Go check out Cruise Club. Last week was Mission Impossible 2. Next week is Vanilla Sky, so go check that out on the other feed, the Cruise Club feed, because Fridays are for fun. But go do those things. Hanks of the Memories, Cruise Club, all 25, actually 26 shows now, because Mike and I have, for some reason, started another podcast, the Elvis Presley Viva Pod Vegas podcast. Release schedule, who knows? Go check that out. That should be up soon or now, anywhere you get podcasts. Me and Mike watching all of Elvis Presley's 31 movies from the 50s and 60s with some special guests that you know and you love, including one who might have been on our show this evening. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Kyra Gaylor-Regan of the Wistful Thinking Podcast. And we'll see you next time for Philadelphia, right here on Hanks for the Memory.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on.
Where is Seattle?
Right.
Where is Baltimore?
That's right there!